Mid-May will now be known for two historic events at Michigan State University. On May 14, 1857, the first students began classes at what was then known as the Agricultural College of the State of Michigan. The same week, 161 years later, would be remembered for another chapter in school history.
And Michigan State University has reached a $500 million settlement with the women and girls abused by former gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar.
Some survivors say they feel vindicated by this settlement, but they also insist their fight for justice is far from over.
Nassar's victims, overwhelmingly young female gymnasts.
Larry Nassar, I hate you.
The trauma that's been done has been done, and most of us will live with it for the rest of our lives, and no amount of money can change that.
As MSU prepares to pay a $500 million settlement to the women abused by former physician Larry Nassar, we ask, what's next? This is a special edition of Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Thank you for joining us. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. 332 is the number of women who were sexually abused by former MSU Dr. Larry Nassar. This week, Michigan State agreed to pay $500 million to those victims to settle hundreds of claims. Capital correspondent Shayna Roth breaks down the settlement and what it means in this case.
Morgan McCall was just 12 years old the first time she stepped into Larry Nassar's office. She was a dancer who tore both her hip flexors and attended an MSU clinic. Now, about to be a sophomore in college, she's one of 332 sexual assault survivors who took on Michigan State University.
When you talk about the number of prolonged, painful nights and, you know, what every survivor had to go through to get to this point, it's been difficult.
When she spoke during Nassar's sentencing in January, Morgan called out the university for not stopping Nassar before he could ever get to her.
Since reports of Larry Nassar's misconduct to Michigan State faculty began in 1997, 2 years before I was even born, I can't help but wonder how many little girls could have been spared from this lifelong battle if someone at the university had just done the bare minimum and listened?
McCall says with this lawsuit wrapping up, she's focused on changes at MSU. Although she goes to a different university, McCall has been a vocal advocate for reform at Michigan State. She says there's a problem with the structure of the university that allowed someone like Larry Nassar to thrive for decades.
I just want to see real change. We have a lot of words and, you know, renewed commitments to transparency and accountability, but we're not seeing those structural changes being made.
Survivors had hoped to include that type of institutional change as part of the settlement. They didn't get that, though school officials say they're working to prevent sexual misconduct on campus. State lawmakers also say the settlement isn't the only answer to what Nassar did. For months, they've been debating more than 30 bills meant to prevent sexual assault and increase penalties. Republican Senator Margaret O'Brien has spearheaded that effort, which includes lengthening the amount of time victims would have to sue institutions like MSU for sexual assault.
I appreciate Michigan State offering this settlement and agreeing to a settlement, but we still need to improve the environment for our young children. We need to eradicate childhood sexual abuse.
The case against MSU isn't the only lawsuit, and its settlement won't impact cases against other organizations like USA Gymnastics and the United States Olympic Committee. USA Gymnastics issued a statement saying it's encouraged by the settlement and that it wants to reach a resolution as well. But attorney Jamie White, who represents about 40 survivors, says that's not the impression he's gotten from the organization. He has clients that are a part of the MSU and USA Gymnastics settlement.
I don't want to speak for them, but it does appear that they might want to fight this to the death. And if that's the case, we're going to oblige them.
The MSU agreement still has to go through several more steps before it's finalized. I'm Shayna Roth in Lansing.
Now we have more responses from some of the women abused by Larry Nassar, including the first woman to make the claims public. Here's WKAR's Katie Cook.
In a statement to WKAR, Nassar survivor Larissa Boyce writes that she is very happy that there has been a resolution, but is, quote, disappointed that they were not able to come to an agreement with non-monetary requests, even something as simple as a true apology, end quote. When Boyce was a teenager in the late 90s, she told her gymnastics coach, Kathy Klagas, that she was uncomfortable with Nassar's treatments. Boyce says in her statement, quote, "I will not rest until we see changes in policy at MSU and state legislation in order to further shine a light on the culture of abuse that exists in our society. Writing a check does not bring healing to me as a survivor. We still have a long way to go in order to ensure our children are safer and people will be held accountable for their actions or inaction. My healing will come through our continued fight to protect our children," end quote. Rachel Denhollander was the first to publicly accuse Nassar of sexual abuse. She released a statement in response to the settlement, saying she is thankful the litigation phase is over so she and her sister survivors can move forward. She says, quote, "Moving forward for myself and many others means continuing to advocate, to call for accountability, and stand for those who have yet to have a voice," end quote. Denhollander writes that she will continue to advocate for accountability and change at U.S. Gymnastics and the United States Olympic Committee, and she calls for the Michigan House of Representatives to pass the reform package, which she says is desperately needed as the first step in legislative reform. For the many MSU students asking themselves what comes next, outgoing student body vice president Arama Opuje-Donka has a message. She says now that the settlement has been made, students have to keep pushing the administration to follow through and make the changes they need to make, like finding a president.
We have to keep pressure on them to make sure that presidential search happens soon, has a really inclusive process, and also that they are bringing someone in who knows how to handle changing the culture on campus and who is invested in listening to the voices of the MSU community.
Opuje-Donka echoes many Nassar survivors when she says that she, too, is happy the settlement has been reached, but there is still a lot left to do. For WKAR News, I'm Katie Cook.
On the morning after the settlement was announced, MSU interim president John Engler talked with NPR's Rachel Martin about the settlement, future investigations, and safety. Here's a portion of that interview.
I appreciate you joining us. I wonder if you see this settlement as closure for the university?
I'd say it's partial closure. It's part of a larger problem I think the nation is confronting when we deal with sexual misconduct and sexual assault. The Me Too movement isn't going away, nor should it. I'm the father of three daughters. I mean, there are a lot of issues that deal with relations between men and women. This probably is somewhat closure for one evil doctor who, after he left the Olympics in 1996, Michigan State was so excited to get the Olympic doctor, the red, white, and blue doctor. He came and put on the green and white, and from 97 through 2016, when it was discovered what he was doing, he plied his trade, and he abused and assaulted a lot of women. And as you noted, that number is at 332. What's so interesting and so sad is 175 parents were in the rooms while the assaults were occurring.
Well, let me ask you, you're serving as the school's president because the former president was forced to resign over this. There is still an ongoing investigation by the Michigan Attorney General's office into the school. Do you have concerns about what might come out of that?
Not at all, actually. I mean, we welcomed the investigation. In fact, the Board of Trustees invited them in. Michigan State had done an internal investigation in preparation for the inevitable litigation, and in the course of that investigation, had made it very clear if anybody were thought to be engaged in any criminal misconduct or involved in a cover-up, knew about Nassar but said nothing, they would be dealt with and be reported to the authorities. They didn't find anybody. The Attorney General hasn't either.
I want to play some tape from one of Nassar's victims. Many of the victims say the settlement should have included mandatory institutional changes at the school. Let's listen to this tape from Morgan McCall.
I just want to see real change. We have a lot of words and, you know, renewed commitments to transparency and accountability, but we're not seeing those structural changes being made.
Is she right? Does more change need to come to Michigan State?
She's completely wrong. Only 31, but only is a huge number. 31 were Michigan State students. Many others were not our students. But on the campus, the efforts on prevention that are being made that have already been put in place, the changes in how you would respond to a complaint of misconduct, sexual assault, are, you know, amazing. As far as a patient, and these were patients, I'm confident the changes made in the medical schools and the clinics make it impossible for another Nassar ever to be undiscovered. This is a sea change in terms of what's happened. So
okay.
I think the survivors have been through an awful lot,
And now maybe there'll be a chance to look at the changes that have been made. And I think when those are studied, they're going to be, I think, very pleased. And well, I think Michigan State's going to be a leader in the nation in terms of dealing with sexual misconduct.
And that was MSU Interim President John Engler talking with NPR's Rachel Martin about the $500 million settlement with Larry Nassar's abuse victims. Now we're asking what's next. This week, Associated Press Lansing reporter David Eggert published a story on how the $500 million settlement will be divided between Nassar's victims, and he joins me now to talk about that. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me.
So we know $425 million will go to the 332 women and girls who say Nassar abused them. Who will decide how much each victim will receive?
Well, soon the lawyers will get together to essentially pick or agree on what's likely going to be former judges or mediators to handle the process and essentially decide how the money is divided up.
Could we see some victims receive more than others?
Yes, that's definitely expected to happen. In these types of situations, what's going to happen is this mediator will gauge each victim's case and claim, and you know, the way it was described to me is there almost be like a big grid system, and they'll look at various factors to determine who gets what. I mean, if you averaged it out, it would be each survivor would get about $1.3 million, but it's largely expected that, you know, some will get, could get more than that, and some will get less than that.
Among the determining factors could be things like age and when their report happened, right?
Yes. You know, the factors could include, you know, whether the victim was a minor at the time of the abuse, which is believed to have happened in a number of the cases. Also, you'll see factors such as how old the claim is, you know, what sort of, how long the victim was treated by Larry Nassar. You know, some victims saw him once or twice, some saw him hundreds of times. So they're probably going to evaluate the extent and duration of the assaults. And they'll also look at factors like medical bills, mental health counseling, you know, whether, you know, a victim has been in mental health counseling, will need future mental health counseling. They'll also look at lost wages and factors such as that.
You talked with an attorney not involved with the Nassar case. He had some advice on dividing the payments.
Yeah, I mean, he said he's been involved with some of the big settlements involving the Catholic Church. And, you know, he said that ultimately these sorts of pools of money are probably the best way to go because it's a fair process. You have a few mediators involved and they can kind of independently evaluate everyone's claim. So you're not having individual lawyers and kind of battling it out over on behalf of their clients. This person or people can kind of take a holistic approach and, you know, divide up the money in the best way they see fit. Also, there would apparently will be an appeals process, and, you know, everybody has said it should be a transparent process. And, you know, some survivors won't be happy, but all in all, the thought is settling this now is a much better way to go than, you know, going into court and kind of reliving a lot of this.
Thank you, David Eggert, Associated Press reporter based in Lansing, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We were talking with him about how the $500 million settlement between MSU and Larry Nassar's victims will be divided. And you can read this article on WKAR.org. WKAR News is committed to staying on top of the story, including next week when a U.S. Senate committee is expected to hear from MSU officials about the handling of the Larry Nassar case. Join us for coverage on 90.5 FM, on your radio, and online at WKAR.org, the WKAR app, or ask your smart speaker to play WKAR. Just ahead, some other stories. We'll take you to Portland, where a century-old school building is helping solve the affordable housing crunch. Find out how the East Lansing Art Festival will cope with major construction in the downtown area. And later, the man who helped set up the internet as we know it tells us where it's headed. You're listening to Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick. For nearly two decades, a two-story brick school building in Ionia County housed generations of young learners. Now the building is home again, this time for families and singles in Portland. WKAR's Katie Cook was there for the grand opening.
It's a big bathroom. It's huge. You get your own washer and dryers. They're huge.
Diane Schaefer is really excited about her new apartment.
I mean, you could put a bed in here if you wanted.
She's one of the first tenants of Portland School Apartments, an old school turned apartment building consisting of 29 new 1, 2, and 3-bedroom apartments.
My dining room, living room. Kitchen.
They're open concept apartments with contemporary finishes and energy-saving appliances. They have dishwashers and washers and dryers. And many units feature high ceilings. Built in 1919, the Portland School Building served as a school until 1996, when it was temporarily used for housing, and then sat vacant and decaying for many years. It's a building full of memories for the residents of Portland. Sandy Pearson spoke at the grand opening to share some stories of going to school there.
It's literally these steps out this door that the very first boy, he and I wanted to share a kiss. And he was going to invite me to the dance that evening. And I had to announce to him that I had the chicken pox. And he immediately broke up with me. And I was devastated.
The building faced demolition, but Woda Cooper Companies, out of Ohio, saw it as an opportunity for creating modern affordable housing. The company has built 325 affordable communities in the past 28 years. Managing Director David Cooper Jr. says this project was especially rewarding to finish because, being a historical building, it presented some challenges along the way.
One of the things that happens with a building like this is, in today's world, you don't have a lot of craftsmen who do things like plaster walls. So we had to find people to repair plaster. Each of the windows had to be specially made for the building and approved by the State Historic Commission. All the millwork inside had to be specially made and the hardware specially made to match old historic standards. So all those things present challenges.
Portland School Apartments was a $7.42 million development. It was made possible with historic credits from the National Park Service and low-income housing tax credits allocated by Michigan State Housing Development Authority, or MSHDA. Earl Pileski is MSHDA's executive director. He says he's excited to be involved with changing the perception of affordable and low-income housing.
This is the model of affordable housing now in America. Beautifully done, a good neighbor, okay? Regrettably, many people have unfortunate ideas of what affordable housing looks like. It's not attractive, it's unsafe. That is not the case anymore. It's beautifully attractive, just like this, and a very pleasant and safe place to live.
The apartments are intended for seniors and working singles or families that earn up to 60% of area median income, which in Portland is currently $60,800 per year. Portland Mayor Jim Barnes says the apartments meet a need the city has for affordable housing. And he describes the process of transforming the abandoned school as miraculous.
It's been a wonderful transition from what we were so afraid of, being an eyesore and something that was reducing property values and so forth, to something that is now a centerpiece for this part of town. And it's going to benefit not only the people that live around the building and in the building, but the entire city as well.
This is my bedroom.
While Diane Schaefer enjoys getting settled into her new home, Portland School Apartments continues to accept applications. To find out more, visit WKAR.org.
But this is where all the sunshine comes in here. And I'm going to get succulents to put on my windowsill.
For WKAR News, I'm Katie Cook.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR. This weekend is the annual East Lansing Art Festival. There are changes to accommodate downtown East Lansing construction. But festival director Michelle Carlson tells WKAR Scott Pohl there is still plenty to see and experience.
It's been a little bit of a challenge because our new footprint, which basically we flipped the festival over, if you can visualize that, and moved most of it east, and are utilizing the Bailey surface lot for our main stage and food court. But that space is our new footprint's a little more condensed. There's not as much wide open space as we've had before. So it's been a little challenging fitting all our pieces in.
Has that forced you to admit fewer artists this
year?
We
have probably about 10 fewer artists, but still wonderful art. So it's going to be the best of the best. We had nearly 500 applications, so for about 170 spots. So it was very competitive.
Now, the old footprint is no more because of the construction that's underway. It used to be something of an H shape because it
yes.
ran up towards City Hall. Is there some of that going on too further east, or is it more of a straight line now?
It's going to be pretty much a straight line. We'll still be on MAC Avenue, so we kind of have that connection with the MSU Arts and Crafts Show across the street, across Grand River. And we'll also be using Ann Street Plaza, which is the plaza right in the center of downtown where the clock tower is. And then we'll be just going down east on Albert Avenue all the way to Bailey. So it will be like an L shape.
And there will be more than one music stage.
Yes, correct? we have three stages, actually. We have a family stage, which will be in Ann Street Plaza, featuring family-friendly performances and workshops for kids. A small stage on the west side or east side of the Marriott in that little plaza. And then the main stage with our feature acts in the Bailey parking lot.
Just a real quick question. Are we expecting this footprint to be the same in future years?
We're not sure yet because we don't know what the construction will be like, but we'll just be there this year for sure.
We've invited Michelle Carlson to join us today. Michelle is director of the East Lansing Art Festival. Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
Good to have you here today.
Thank you.
All right. Parking is always an issue with the new footprint. Maybe it's a different issue this year. What are you telling people to do about parking?
All the city ramps will be open, and the two larger ramps off Grand River on Division and Charles Street, they'll be accessible from Grand River, and they're going to have a flat fee during festival hours. So it's a $5 entry fee. The gates will be open for exiting, so that will be really convenient and close parking. All other parking lots that aren't being used by the festival will be open, and those will be regular rates.
Is there shuttle service from anywhere?
Unfortunately, CATA was not able to offer the shuttle service. You can still park in the available spots on campus, but you'd have to use regular CATA service. There is still bus service around town. We also have a bike valet. So if you live close, you can ride your bike and park it in a secure location near the Marriott Hotel for the festival, and that's free. You can walk.
Sure.
But yeah.
Well, biking's a nice option for folks then. I wanted to ask you about the pet policy. I read it in the paper that animals are not permitted in the food court or the children's arts activities areas, and you recommend leaving pets home. Now, I got to ask you if that's something new, because I've seen people with dogs on leashes every year. Lots of times I've wondered, what the heck, what, leave your dog home. I love dogs, don't misunderstand me, but is that new, the pet
no,
policy?
No, that's kind of been our policy all along. We also love our dogs and cats, and people have brought lizards and birds and snakes and all sorts of pets with them, and we understand that they're parts of people's families. But it's just so many people, and there's kids and things going on that it just seems to be an accident waiting to happen. And for everyone's safety, we just recommend that you don't bring your dog. But if you must be with your dog, please keep it on a leash and have control over it. And if it's too much for the dog or if it's really a warm day, I just suggest leaving it home so it doesn't get injured or have a bad experience.
All right. Now, you mentioned if it's too warm. It just occurs to me, I didn't look ahead to the weather forecast. What are you hearing?
I saw that it's going to be in the 70s sunny to partly cloudy, so I think it'll be a perfect weather weekend for us, especially after all this rain we've had.
I've been very hot in the past. I've been very wet in the past.
It's been very cold in the past,
yes.
Too.
By the way, before I forget to mention it, I'm going to be introducing some of the music acts on the main stage on Sunday, so I hope folks will stop by and enjoy the music and say hello.
Yes, please do.
Tell us more about what's going to be there for kids this year, the family rest tent, sensory tent. I wanted to learn about that too. Tell us about kids' activities.
We have a lot. We have great partners in our kids' activity area, which are Impression 5, Reach Art Studio, Lansing Art Gallery, and Happen Dance are our major partners. And we're going to have a theme of artful insects. We're going to have a community project of creating a large life-size puppet that everyone can work on, and then there'll be individual arts activities to do that are related to insects, and we'll have music and things on the stage. Our sensory tent that we put in the children's areas for people who may feel overwhelmed with the noise or lots of too much going on, they can go in there and have a rest and chill out for a little bit.
The East Lansing Art Festival is Saturday and Sunday. Michelle Carlson is director of the East Lansing Art Festival. Thanks for coming in this morning. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Hope the weather holds out.
Yes, it will.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. Some Detroit residents are exchanging their current homes for abandoned houses the city will renovate for them. The Home Swap program is for people impacted by the construction of the new bridge to Canada. Laura Herberg from our fellow NPR station here in Michigan, WDET, reports.
Maria Wachenbach lives with her four dogs just around the corner from the construction site of the Gordie Howe International Bridge. She's been here in the home she inherited from her mother-in-law for almost 20 years.
My husband actually passed away in this home. So there's a lot of memories in this home. And now that I'm looking to retire in another year or two, I want to start fresh.
So Wachenbach signed up to participate in the first round of the city's home swap program.
This is the website. Have you seen this?
She scrolls through photos of 10 homes the city of Detroit acquired after the previous owners stopped paying taxes. The structures look dilapidated, but the city will spend up to $75,000 renovating them in exchange for participants' homes. Wachenbach has her eye on a little brick house about 7 miles away in the Warrendale neighborhood.
It's a 3-bedroom, 1-bath home, and I love it because it has a humongous backyard with 2 trees my grandboys can climb.
Wachenbach has this opportunity because of a community benefits agreement. It was lobbied for by people living near the bridge site to compensate for the impacts of the construction. A community advisory group convinced the state of Michigan and the city of Windsor to create job training, health monitoring, and home improvement options like Home Swap. Charity Dean is the director of the Bridging Neighborhoods program that oversees Home Swap. She says these benefits are being paid for by the sale of city-owned land needed to build the bridge.
The city was originally offered, you know, $200,000 for the land, and the mayor turned that into a $45 million package.
About $33 million of that went to the Bridging Neighborhoods program that Home Swap is a part of. Residents fought for a program like Home Swap so there'd be an option for people who didn't lose their homes to eminent domain, but who wanted to leave the increasingly industrialized area. In order to participate, homeowners need to be up to date on their water bills and property taxes.
Ostensibly, those are reasonable requirements, but it's just complicated.
That's Michelle Oberholzer. She directs the Tax Foreclosure Prevention Project at the nonprofit United Community Housing Coalition. She says initially several interested families were ineligible for the program because of issues related to their tax and water bills.
It's difficult to get someone to pay out for something that they're then going to leave behind.
Since then, most of those families have resolved their tax and water bill issues, but Oberholzer says she hopes the city will work to find solutions for the handful who haven't. But even some families that are up to date with their bills are running into problems with home swap. Take, for example, the Franco family. You can hear semi-trucks drive by from their front porch. And inside, Myra Franco says the house has been shaking from the ongoing work.
Dile que la casa todo el día se está moviendo.
Every day the house has been moving a lot. So like the floor and everything has been cracking.
That's Franco's teenage son, Javier, translating.
Right here in the basement, like one of the things has been cracked already.
So you're pointing down, there's like a gap.
There's a small crevice between where Franco's tile floor ends and the wall begins. There are also what she says are new cracks in the wood over the stairs. Franco, who has asthma, wants to get out of this house as soon as possible. But she says when she looked at the 10 houses the city made available in the first round, none of them were big enough for her family of six.
Porque no hay suficiente dinero.
She can't pick a bigger house because they told her that they can't fix it because they don't have enough money.
Rehabbing a house the size of Franco's current 5-bedroom home could cost more than the city has allotted for each family in the program. So Franco says she'll be looking for a 4-bedroom house in the next round. But for Maria Walkenbach, a 3-bedroom ranch would be more than enough room. And she found out recently the city gave her the one she'd been eyeing. Today, she's going on the final walkthrough before signing the papers to initiate the swap. Walkenbach steps inside. There's caution tape over the windows, paint chips hanging from the ceiling, and a hole in the wall. Bridging Neighborhood's housing development specialist Antoine Hayes tells Walkenbach that when she comes back and it's all renovated,
you're probably going to cry.
Just the thought of getting a house is unbelievable. See, you got me crying now.
The city says renovations are supposed to take 6 to 9 months. After Walkenbach moves in, her home near the bridge is scheduled to be demolished. The city says it hopes to recruit and relocate more than 200 families. I'm Laura Herberg.
Just ahead, we go one-on-one with one of the fathers of the internet.
At the end of 2018, we believe about 50% of the world's population will have access to the internet.
Vinton Cerf's take on the past and present of the World Wide Web. Keep it here on Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. And welcome back to Current State from your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick. The Quello Center at Michigan State University recently hosted Vinton Cerf of Google. He gave a lecture called Internet Past, Present, and Future. Cerf is widely hailed as a father of the internet, having worked on the architecture of what became the web at its earliest stages. And during his visit, he spoke with WKAR's Scott Pohl.
As the father of the internet, so-called, how would you say today's internet compares with your early vision for the possibilities of this technology?
Well, first of all, let me point out I'm not the only father of the internet. Bob Kahn and I did the original design back in 1973. And of course, many, many people have had their fingers in the pie since then. We were doing this for the Defense Department, so we were looking at command and control applications, which did involve voice, video, and data, even as far back as the early 70s. So in that sense, the fact that the internet has grown up to support those media is what we hope for, could not be assured of, but we certainly hope for that. Second, we had the experience of the ARPANET to rely on, and we saw not only the educational aspects and the communication aspects, the computer-mediated communication aspects of the system, and we saw some of the social impacts. As a bunch of geeks, we used email distribution lists in order to comment on science fiction writers or restaurants and things like that. So distribution lists were an early effect. However, what we didn't predict, or what I didn't anyway, is what happens when you let the general public onto a global scale system and give them the freedom to largely say whatever they want to say or show whatever they want to show. And that's when you learn what Shakespeare has been teaching us for 400 years, that not everyone has your best interests at heart. And so now we have the conundrum. The general public is online. What do we do about abusive behavior? And how do we cope with that on an international scale? And I think that's something we're going to have to figure out.
So when some hear you referred to as a father of the internet, they might say, oh, you're to blame.
Well,
it's your fault.
You know, I learned a couple of lessons as a parent, and that is not to take too much credit when your kids do well. So when they screw up, you don't have to take too much blame. And so I try to escape some of that by pointing out that what Bob Kahn and I did was kind of like figuring out how to design a road system, how to put rules of the road in place so the cars don't run into each other. But the decision about what kind of vehicle to build, what the vehicle carries, what buildings are adjacent to the roads and what they do has been left to others. And so what happens on the network is partly the result of other people's ambitions and invention.
How long have you been with Google?
Since 2005, so I'm working on my 13th year.
All right. Now, a lot of people know that Google co-founder Larry Page, as I'm sure you know, grew up here in East Lansing. His parents, Gloria and Carl, taught computer programming and computer science here at MSU. So would you describe for us what you see as Larry Page's place in history, noting that he's only 45 years old?
Well, he's already made a name for himself in several dimensions, not the least of which he's become quite wealthy. But the page ranking algorithm was largely Larry's, if I've understood correctly. He was also the guy with the business model in his head. He didn't have the advertising business model, but that came fairly early in the story of Google. And so I think that Larry and Sergey both get enormous credit for encouraging people to shoot for 10x, even if it doesn't work, rather than 0.1x that is guaranteed. And so allowing people to try things that might not work is a hallmark of Larry's management style, and it shows in what's happened at Google.
One question for you is about federal net neutrality legislation. Do you have a personal position on it? Does it differ from Google's corporate position on net neutrality?
Well, we were very aligned a few years ago, and I was a vocal spokesperson for net neutrality. Google has been a little quieter on the topic, but I still believe that it's a very important concept that should be instantiated in an enforceable way. However, there are some people who misunderstand what is meant by net neutrality. What I mean by this is not that every packet is treated identically. I think low latency is important. I think high capacity is important. It does not mean you can't charge for more usage. What it means is that everyone, every user, whether that's a company or a person, should have equal access under the same terms and conditions to the various services of the network. So that might mean low latency for video games. It might mean high capacity for file transfers. So it's just that it's the fairness of access under the same terms and conditions that counts. It also means that the providers of broadband access to the net should not be allowed to interfere with someone else's application to benefit their applications above the access layer. That's an anti-competitive issue, and I think that's what's important to instantiate. The fact that it was lodged in Title II of the Communications Act was awkward, but that was the only place to put it that had the adequate differentiations. What should happen is a new title in the Telecom Act for Internet access, which should be rendered neutral and fair and assure user choice. And if we can get there, perhaps with a more cooperative Congress than we have now, that would be a good outcome.
Is Chief Evangelist at Google an official title?
My official title is Vice President and Chief Internet Evangelist.
Yes.
And yes, it is. When I joined the company, Larry and Sergey and Eric said, "What title do you want?" And I thought for a moment and I suggested Archduke. I thought that was a really great title. However, they went away and came back and said, you know, the previous Archduke was Ferdinand, and he was assassinated in 1914. It started World War I. Why don't you be our chief internet evangelist? And I said, okay, I can do that. And so my job is rich with opportunity, but a big focus of attention is getting more internet built around the world. At the end of 2018, we believe about 50% of the world's population will have access to the internet. So I still have another 3.7 billion or so people to convert.
Is it challenging to evangelize about the internet when the web is so widely criticized these days for being vulnerable to those who have nefarious intent?
No. And the reason for that is that there's also so much of value that people are finding on the net, the opportunities for trying out new ideas, creating new businesses, for sharing information, for collaboration. I mean, it's just an incredibly powerful global scale thing. And so the result is that people understand that there are issues that need to be addressed, but I don't think they're prepared to throw away the entire internet simply because we have some challenges that need to be addressed.
One final question about the future of the internet, what you envision, maybe even things we can't imagine today. What's ahead?
Well, there are several things that are absolutely predictable right now. First of all, it's more wireless access at higher speeds for sure. Second, the Internet of Things is a tsunami that's on its way with both benefits and some serious potential deficits, security, safety, privacy, reliability, all of those things, scaling and the ability to manage large numbers of devices, or what happens when you sell your house and somebody comes and arrives with another 200 devices and doesn't want to spend the next week typing IPv6 addresses to configure everything. So we have that to worry about. I am persuaded that many of the machine learning and artificial intelligence techniques that are becoming more and more applied will make our lives interesting, because the network will be just there. You won't be thinking about logging into the internet. It will simply be another facility, like plugging into the wall to get electrons. I can confidently say that the interplanetary extension of the internet, which is already in operation, will certainly expand over the decades ahead, providing a backbone to support manned and robotic exploration of our solar system. And those protocols have been standardized over the last 20 years with some serious work at NASA and the other spacefaring nations around the world. So I'm pretty sure we're going to see a very, very rich and evolving environment in which the internet is still embedded.
Vinden Cerf is Vice President and Chief Internet Evangelist at Google. Thank you.
A big pleasure to be here. Thanks.
For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
This week, Ramadan, a holy time for Muslims, began. While engaging in a month-long dawn-to-dusk fast, Muslims must also abstain from sex, gossip, and cursing. Muslims are also encouraged to spend time in contemplation, prayer, reading the Quran, and charity during the day. From our archives, WKAR's Katie Cook talked with a Muslim couple from the Lansing area about what this time of year means to them.
The sun is about to set on a Tuesday evening during Ramadan, and Omar El-Sharif and Katie Halaba are in their apartment preparing for iftar, the meal they will eat to break the day's fast.
Do you want any tea?
They set the table, and then Omar explains the first step.
So we start off breaking the fast by saying Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It means just, you know, in the name of God, you know, we thank Him for this blessing, and then we just drink. Mm-hmm.
Then they eat dates.
So then we usually have a date. Mm-hmm. We have either one date or three dates.
Odd numbers are tradition, according to Sunnah, the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. After they break the fast, they pray. And then the meal.
All right, get some coffee.
Katie and Omar are both in their early 20s, and they're engaged to be married next month. Omar studied mechanical engineering at MSU, and Katie is at MSU studying Arabic and teaching English to speakers of other languages. Like many couples, they have a cute story. They first met on campus at a Muslim Students Association event, and then they met again at a friend's potluck. There was a snowstorm and everyone's cars got buried.
And we came out and we were like, oh my gosh, you know, our cars were totally like stuck in these huge snowbanks. And this guy shoveled out all the cars while I just like stood and talked.
Yeah. And, I wanted to make sure she gets home safely. That's why.
So he made an impression.
They both practice Islam, but they come from very different backgrounds. Katie is from Michigan.
So I was raised Catholic, and when I was in middle school, my family left the Catholic Church and began attending Quaker meetings in Ann Arbor.
When she left for college, she decided to focus on Middle Eastern studies and Arabic. She got involved with Muslim groups on campus to learn more about their culture and faith. One semester, she was having a difficult time, and she turned to the Quran.
I went home one day, and I was like, I'm going to read this. And I read the whole thing, and when I got to the end, I was like, this makes sense to me. Like, everything just kind of clicked.
Soon after that, she converted to Islam. Omar, on the other hand, grew up in the Muslim faith. Originally from Egypt, he also lived in New York and the United Arab Emirates before coming to Michigan for college. He says that's when he began to really define what Islam means to him.
I would define it as a way of life, you know, being in peace, submitting to God, and you know, following the teachings, and just going about your life, you know, being thankful for what you have to who gave it to you, basically.
Because they each took a different path to Islam, their experiences of Ramadan have also been different. Omar remembers Ramadan as a time of togetherness.
Growing up, Ramadan was always about family and always about the huge gatherings. We would eat home maybe like only that first week, and then every other day we're out being, you know, invited by someone else, and we, you know, vice versa, we invite people over. So it was always a condensed month of family and family friends.
For Katie, it was a journey that wasn't always easy.
My experience of Ramadan has changed dramatically every year. My first Ramadan, I was living by myself. I had just moved to Lansing. I transferred to MSU, and I didn't know anybody here yet. And so my first Ramadan, I was just like completely by myself every day, every night. It was really lonely. It was really sad. You know, I was like, I don't know what's supposed to be happening during this time, but it feels like everybody else is with their families. So it was a really difficult time.
But she soon found community with other Muslim families who invited her into their homes. Today, both Omar and Katie value Ramadan as a season to reflect, study the Quran, and focus on self-discipline and helping others. Despite their different backgrounds, the two have been able to merge their cultures and find common ground between their families.
You know, we had to go through the loopholes of, you know, having two different, completely different cultures fuse into one. Mm-hmm. And it was hard at the time, but I'm glad that we pushed through it, and we were adamant that it will make it work.
Yeah, and it was a nice surprise for us that even though our families are from very different cultures and faiths and backgrounds, they're surprisingly really similar in so many different ways. Just, you know, the family culture is very similar, and so it was a nice surprise to find out that our families get along really well.
And Omar and Katie look forward to building their life and their own family, continuing past traditions and creating new ones together. For WKAR, I'm Katie Cook.
Finally today, we here at WKAR invite you to join us in the Great American Read, sparking a national conversation about reading, literacy, and the books that have inspired us. The top 100 books of all time will be featured during a two-hour special airing on WKAR-TV on May 22nd at 8 p.m. Then it's up to you. Read the books, vote from the list of 100, and share your personal connections to the titles. WKAR will also host several community events throughout the summer right here in the Greater Lansing area to promote this series. For more information about all of this, log on to WKAR.org and look for the colorful Great American Read box on the right-hand side of the homepage. That's all for this edition of Current State. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. Thank you for listening. We leave you with Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5. In mid-June, a Detroit street will be renamed after the late King of Pop. And on the same day, his brothers Jackie, Tito, Jermaine, and Marlon will perform at a festival. Here's one of the songs that put the Jackson 5 and Motown on the map, I Want You Back.